Chapter 49. London. Clive Roach knew he had a problem the moment Rudolph entered the crowded carriage. Roach would be all right as long as the agent remained seated inside his compartment, but if the agent left the compartment to go to the lavatory, or the restaurant car, or another carriage, Roach was in trouble. The corridors were jammed with travellers, some standing, some sitting, and trying vainly to doze. Moving about the train was an ordeal. One had to squeeze and push past people and constantly say, "Excuse me," and "Beg your pardon." Trying to follow someone without being detected would be difficult, probably impossible if the agent was good. And everything Roach had seen thus far told him Rudolph was good. Roach became suspicious when Rudolph, clutching his stomach, stepped from his compartment while the train was still at the platform at Euston Station and sliced forward along the crowded corridor. Rudolph was short, no more than 5'6", and his head quickly disappeared into the sea of passengers. Roach picked his way forward a few steps, earning him the grunts and groans of the other passengers. He was reluctant to get too close. Rudolph had doubled back several times during the day, and Roach feared he might have seen his face. The corridor was poorly lit because of blackout regulations, and already shrouded in a fog bank of cigarette smoke. Roach stayed in the shadows and watched as Rudolph knocked twice on the lavatory door. Another passenger pushed past him, obstructing his view for just a few seconds. When he looked up again, Rudolph was gone. Roach stayed where he was for 3 minutes, watching the lavatory door. Another man approached, knocked, then went inside and closed the door behind him. Alarm bells sounded inside Roach's head. He pushed his way forward through the knot of passengers in the corridor, stopped in front of the lavatory door, and pounded on it. "Wait your turn like everyone else!" came the voice on the other side. "Open the door! Police emergency!" The man opened the door a few seconds later, buttoning his fly. Roach looked inside to make sure Rudolph was not there. Damn it! He threw open the door to the connecting passage and entered the next carriage. Like the other, it was dark and smoky and hopelessly crammed with passengers. It would be impossible for him to find Rudolph now without turning over the train carriage by carriage, compartment by compartment. He thought, how did he vanish so quickly? He hurried back to the first carriage and found the ticket collector, an old man with steel-rimmed spectacles and a club foot. Roach withdrew the surveillance photograph of Rudolph and stuck it in front of the ticket collector's face. "Have you seen this man?"
"Short chap?"
"Yes," Roach said, his spirits sinking lower, thinking, "Damn it, damn it."
"He jumped off the train as we pulled out of Euston. Lucky he didn't break his bloody leg."
"Christ! Why didn't you say something?" He realized how ridiculous the remark must have sounded. He forced himself to speak more calmly. "Where does this train make its first stop?"
"Watford."
"When?"
"About 30 minutes.
"Too long. I have to get off this train now." Roach reached up, grabbed the emergency brake cord, and pulled. The train immediately slowed as the brakes were applied and began to stop. The old ticket collector looked up at Roach, eyes blinking rapidly behind the spectacles, and said,
"You're not a normal police officer, are you?"
Roach said nothing as the train drew to a halt. He threw open the door, dropped down to the edge of the track, and disappeared into the darkness. Neumann paid off the taxi a short distance from the Pope warehouse and walked the rest of the way. He switched his Mauser from the waistband of his trousers to the front pocket of his reefer coat, and then turned up his collar against the driving rain. The first act had gone smoothly. The deception on the train had worked exactly as he hoped. Neumann was certain he was not followed after leaving Euston Station. That meant one thing. McIntosh, the man who had tailed him onto the train, was almost certainly still on it, and heading out of London bound for Liverpool. The watcher was not an idiot. Eventually he would realize Neumann had not returned to his compartment, and he would begin a search. He might ask questions. Neumann's escape had not gone unseen. The ticket collector had spotted him jumping from the train. When the watcher realized Neumann was no longer on the train, he would get off at the next stop and telephone his superiors in London. Neumann realized he had a very limited window of opportunity. He had to move quickly. The warehouse was dark and appeared deserted. Neumann rang the bell and waited. There was no response. He rang the bell again, and this time could hear the sound of footsteps on the other side. The door was opened a moment later by a black-haired giant in a leather coat.
"What do you want?"
"I'd like to see Mr. Pope, please," Neumann said politely. "I need a few items, and I was told this was very definitely the place to come." "Mr. Pope is gone, and we're out of business, so piss off." The giant started to close the door. Neumann put his foot in the way. "I'm sorry, it's really rather urgent. Perhaps you could help." The giant looked at Neumann, a puzzled look on his face. He seemed to be trying to reconcile the public school accent with the reefer coat and bandaged face. "I suppose you didn't hear me the first time," he said. "We're out of business. Shut down." He grabbed Neumann's shoulder. "Now fuck off!" Neumann punched the giant in the Adam's apple, then pulled out his Mauser and shot him in the foot. The man collapsed on the floor, alternately howling in pain and gasping for breath. Neumann stepped inside and closed the gate. The warehouse was just the way Catherine described it. Vans, cars, motorbikes, stacks of black market food, and several jerrycans of petrol. Neumann leaned down and said, "If you make a move, I'll shoot you again, and it won't be in the foot. Do you understand?" The giant grunted. Neumann selected a black van, opened the door, and started the motor. He grabbed two jerrycans of petrol and put them in the back of the van. On second thought, it was a very long drive. He took two more and put them in the back, too. He climbed inside the van, drove it to the front of the warehouse, then got out and hauled open the main door. Before leaving, he knelt beside the wounded man and said, "If I were you, I'd get straight to a hospital." The man looked at Neumann, more confused than ever. "Who the hell are you, mate?" Neumann smiled. Knowing the truth would sound so absurd, the man would never believe it. "I'm a German spy on the run from MI5.
"Yeah, and I'm bloody Adolf Hitler."
Neumann climbed in the van and sped away. Harry Dalton tore the blackout shades from the headlamps and drove dangerously fast westward across London. Transport section had offered a skilled high-speed driver, but Harry wanted to do the driving himself. He weaved in and out of traffic, one hand constantly pressing the horn. Vickery sat next to him on the front seat, nervously clutching the dash. The wipers struggled in vain to beat away the rain. Turning into the Cromwell Road, Harry accelerated so hard the rear end of the car slid on the slick tarmac. He sliced and snaked his way through the traffic, then turned south into Earl's Court Road. He entered a small side street, then raced down a narrow alley, swerving once to avoid a rubbish bin, then again to miss a cat. He slammed on the brakes behind a block of flats and brought them to a skidding halt. Harry and Vickery got out of the car, entered the building through the rear service door, and pounded up the stairs toward the fifth floor to the surveillance flat. Vickery, ignoring the pain shooting through his knee like a knife, kept pace with Harry. He thought, if only Boothby had let me arrest them hours ago, we wouldn't be in this mess. It was nothing short of a disaster. The agent codenamed Rudolph had just jumped from a train at Euston Station and melted into the city. Vickery had to assume he was now attempting to flee the country. He had no choice but to arrest Catherine Blake. He needed her in custody and scared out of her wits. Then she might tell them where Rudolph was headed and how he planned to escape, whether other agents were involved, and where he kept his radio. Vickery was not optimistic. Everything he felt about this woman told him she would not cooperate, even when faced with execution. All she had to do was hold out long enough for Rudolph to escape. If she did that, the Abwehr would possess evidence suggesting British intelligence was engaged in a massive deception. The consequences were too awful to contemplate. All the work that had gone into Fortitude would be wasted. The Germans could deduce that the Allies were coming at Normandy. The invasion would have to be postponed and replanned. Otherwise, it would end in a blood-soaked catastrophe. Hitler's iron-handed occupation of Western Europe would go on. Countless more would die. And all because Vickery's operation had fallen to pieces. They had one chance now. Arrest her, make her talk, and stop Rudolph before he could flee the country or use his radio. Harry pushed open the door to the surveillance flat and led them inside. The curtains were open to the street, the room in darkness. Vickery struggled to make out the figures standing in various poses all around the room, like statuary in a darkened garden. A pair of bleary-eyed watchers, frozen in the window, a half-dozen tense Special Branch men leaning against one wall. The senior Special Branch officer was called Carter. He was big and bluff, with a thick throat and pockmarked skin. A cigarette, extinguished for security, jutted from the corner of his generous mouth. When Harry introduced Vickery, he pumped Vickery's hand ferociously once, then led him to the window to explain the disposition of his forces. The dead cigarette flaked ash as he spoke.
"We'll go in through the front door," Carter said,
a trace of North Country in his accent.
"When we do, we'll seal the street at both ends, and a pair of men will cover the back of the house. Once we're in the house, she'll have nowhere to go." "It's extremely important that you take her alive," Vickery said. "She's absolutely useless to us dead." "Harry says she's good with her weapons."
"True. We have reason to believe she has a gun and is willing to use it."
"We'll take her so fast she won't know what hit her. We're ready whenever you give us the word."
Vickery turned from the window and walked across the room to the telephone. He dialed the department and waited for the operator to forward the call to Boothby's office. "The Special Branch men are ready to move on our order," Vickery said, when Boothby came on the line. "Do we have authorization yet?"
"No. The 20 Committee are still deliberating, and we can't move until they approve it. The ball's in their court now." "My God! Perhaps someone should explain to the 20 Committee that time is one thing we don't have in great abundance. If we have one chance in hell of catching Rudolph, we need to know where he's going."
"I understand your dilemma," Boothby said. Vickery thought, "Your dilemma?"
"My dilemma, Sir Basil?"
He said, "When are they going to decide?"
"Any moment. I'll call you back straight away."
Vickery rang off and paced the dark room. He turned to one of the watchers and said, "How long has she been in there?"
"About 15 minutes.
15 minutes? Why did she stay on the street so long?"
"I don't like it." The telephone rang. Vickery lunged for it and brought the receiver to his ear. Basil Boothby said,
"We have the 20 Committee's approval. Bring her in, Alfred, and good luck."
Vickery slammed down the receiver.
"We're on, gentlemen."
He turned to Harry.
"Alive. We need her alive."
Harry nodded, grim-faced, then led the Special Branch men out of the room. Vickery listened to their footfalls on the stairs gradually fading away. Then, a moment later, he spotted the tops of their heads as they stepped from the building and headed across the street toward Catherine Blake's flat. Horst Neumann parked the van in a small, quiet side street around the corner from Catherine's flat. He climbed out and softly closed the door. He walked quickly along the pavement, hands thrust deeply into his pockets, one hand wrapped around the butt of the Mauser. The street was in pitch darkness. He came to the pile of rubble that once was the terrace behind the flat. He groped his way across broken wood, crumbled brick, and twisted pipes. The rubble ended at a wall about 6 feet high. On the other side of the wall was the garden at the back of the house. Neumann had seen it from the window of her room. He tried the gate. It was locked. He would have to open it from the other side. He placed his hands on top of the wall, thrust with his legs, and pulled with his arms. Atop the wall now, he threw one leg over the other side and turned his body. He hung that way for a few seconds, looking down. The ground below was invisible in the dark. He could fall on anything, a sleeping dog or a row of dustbins that would make a terrible clatter if he landed on them. He considered shining his torch for a second, but that might attract attention. He pushed himself off the top of the wall and fell through the gloom. There were no dogs or rubbish bins, just a thorny shrub of some kind that clawed at his face and his coat. Neumann tore himself free from the thorn bush and unlatched the gate. He crossed the garden to the back door. He tried the latch. It was locked. The door had a window. He reached in his coat pocket, withdrew the Mauser, and used it to smash the lower left pane of glass. The noise was surprisingly loud. He reached through the shattered pane and unlocked the door, then quickly crossed the hall and ascended the stairs. He reached Catherine's door and knocked softly. From the other side of the door he heard her say,
"Who's there?"
"It's me."
She opened the door. Neumann stepped inside and closed it. She was dressed in trousers, sweater, and leather jacket. The suitcase radio was standing next to the door. Neumann looked at her face. It was ashen.
"It could be my imagination," she said, "but I think something is going on downstairs.
I've seen some men milling about on the street and sitting in parked cars. The flat was dark, one light burning in the sitting room. Neumann crossed the room in a few quick steps and turned it off. He went to the window and lifted the edge of the blackout shade, peering out into the street. The evening traffic was moving below, throwing off just enough light for him to see four men charging from the apartment house across the street and heading their way. Neumann turned and ripped his Mauser from his pocket. "They're coming for us! Grab your radio and follow me down! Now!" Harry Dalton threw open the front door and went inside, the special branch men behind him. He switched on the hall light in time to see Catherine Blake running out the back door, her suitcase radio swinging from her arm. Horst Neumann had kicked open the back door and was running across the garden when he heard the shout from within the house. He rushed through the curtain of gloom, the Mauser in front of him in his outstretched hand. The gate flew open and a figure appeared there, silhouetted in the frame, gun raised. He shouted for Neumann to stop. Neumann kept running, firing twice. The first shot struck the man in the shoulder, spinning him around. The second shattered his spine, killing him instantly. A second man stepped into his place and attempted to fire. Neumann squeezed the trigger. The Mauser bounced in his hand, emitting almost no sound, just the dull click of the firing mechanism. The man's head exploded. Neumann raced through the gate, stepping over the bodies, and peered into the blackout. There was no one else behind the house. He turned and saw Catherine a few feet behind him, running with a radio. Three men were chasing her. Neumann raised his gun and fired into the dark. He heard two men scream. Catherine kept running. He turned and started across the rubble toward the van. Harry felt the rounds whiz past his head. He heard the screams of both men behind him. She was right in front of him. He plunged through the darkness, arms outstretched before him. He realized he was at a distinct disadvantage. He was unarmed and alone. He could stop and try to find one of the special branch men's weapons, then chase them and try to shoot them both. But he was likely to be killed by Rudolph in the process. He could stop, turn around, go back inside, and signal the surveillance flat. But by then, Catherine Blake and Rudolph would be long gone, and they would have to start the damned cert all over again, and the spies would use their radio and tell Berlin about what they had discovered, and we'd lose the fucking war, damn it. The radio. He thought, I may not be able to stop them now, but I can cut them off from Berlin for a while. Harry leapt through the darkness, screaming deep in his throat, and grabbed hold of the suitcase with both hands. He tried to tear it from her grasp, but she turned and pulled with surprising strength. He looked up and saw her face for the first time. Red, contorted with fear, ugly with rage. He tried again to wrench the case from her, but he could not break her grasp. Her fingers were clenched around the handle like a vice grip. She screamed Rudolph's real name. It sounded like Wurst. Then Harry heard a clicking sound. He had heard it before on the streets of East London before the war, the sound of a stiletto blade snapping into place. He saw her arm rise, then swing down in a vicious arc toward his throat. If he raised his own arm, he could deflect the blow, but then she would be able to pull the radio away from him. He held on with both hands and tried to avoid the stiletto by twisting his head. The tip of the blade struck the side of his face. He could feel his flesh tearing. The pain came an instant later, searing, as though molten metal had been thrown against his face. Harry screamed, but held on to the bag. She raised her arm again, this time plunging the tip of the stiletto into his forearm. Harry yelled with pain again, teeth clenched, but his hands would not let go of the bag. It was as if they were acting on their own now. Nothing, no amount of pain could make them let go. She let go of the bag and said, "You're a brave man to die for a radio." Then she turned and disappeared into the darkness. Harry lay on the wet ground. When she was gone, he reached up to touch his face and was sickened when he felt the warm bone of his own jaw. He was losing consciousness. The pain was fading. He heard the wounded special branch men groaning nearby. He felt the rain beating against his face. He closed his eyes. He felt someone pressing something against his face. When he opened his eyes, he saw Alfred Vickery leaning over him. "I told you to be careful, Harry." "Did she get the radio?" "No. You kept her from taking the radio." "Did they get away?" "Yes, but we're chasing them." The pain raced up on Harry very suddenly. He started to tremble and felt as though he was going to throw up. Then Vickery's face turned to water, and Harry blacked out. Chapter 50. London. Within 1 hour of the disaster in Earl's Court, Alfred Vickery had orchestrated the biggest manhunt in the history of the United Kingdom. Every police station in the country, from Penzance to Dover, from Portsmouth to Inverness, was given a description of Vickery's fugitive spies. Vickery dispatched photographs by motorcycle couriers to the cities, towns, and villages close to London. Most officers involved in the search were told the fugitives were suspects in 4 murders dating back to 1938. A handful of very senior officers were discreetly informed it was a security matter of the utmost importance. So important, the Prime Minister was personally monitoring the progress of the hunt. London's Metropolitan Police responded with extraordinary speed, and within 15 minutes of Vickery's first call, roadblocks had been thrown up along all major arteries leading from the city. Vickery tried to cover every possible route of escape. MI5 and railway police prowled the main stations. The operators of the Irish ferries were given a description of the suspects as well. Next, he contacted the BBC and asked for the senior man on duty. On the main 9 o'clock evening news, the BBC led with the story of a shootout in Earl's Court that had left 2 police officers dead and 3 others wounded. The story contained a description of Catherine Blake and Rudolph, and concluded with a telephone number citizens could call with information. Within 5 minutes, the telephones started ringing. The typists transcribed each well-meaning call and passed them on to Vickery. Most he tossed straight into the wastepaper basket. A few he followed up. None produced a single lead. Then he turned his attention to the escape routes only a spy would use. He contacted the RAF and asked them to be on the lookout for light aircraft. He contacted the Admiralty and asked them to keep a careful watch for U-boats approaching the coastline. He contacted the Coast Guard Service and asked them to keep a watch out for small craft heading out to sea. He telephoned the Y Service radio monitors and asked them to listen for suspect wireless transmissions. Vickery stood up from his desk and stepped outside his office for the first time in 2 hours. The command post in West Halkin Street had been deserted, and his team had slowly streamed back to St. James's Street. They sat in the common area outside his office, like dazed survivors of a natural disaster, wet, exhausted, defeated. Clive Roach sat alone, head down, hands folded. Every few moments, one of the watchers would lay a hand on his shoulder, murmur encouragement into his ear, and move quietly on. Peter Jordan was pacing. Tony Blair had fixed a homicidal glare on him. The only sound was the rattle of the teleprinters and the chatter of the girls on the telephone. The silence was broken for a few minutes at 9 o'clock, when Harry Dalton walked into the room, his face and arm bandaged. Everyone stood and crowded around him. "Well done, Harry, old boy. Deserve a medal. You kept us in the game, Harry. Be all over if not for you." Vickery pulled him into his office. "Shouldn't you be lying down resting?"
"Yeah, but I wanted to be here instead."
"How's the pain?"
"Not too bad. They gave me something for it."
"You still have any doubts about how you would react under fire on the battlefield?" Harry managed a half-smile, looked down and shook his head.
"Any breaks yet?"
he asked, quickly changing the subject. Vickery shook his head.
"What have you done?"
Vickery brought him up to date.
"Bold move. Rudolph coming back for her like that, snatching her from under our nose. He's got guts, I'll say that for him. How's Boothby taking it?"
"About as well as can be expected. He's upstairs with the Director General now, probably planning my execution. We have an open line to the underground war rooms and the Prime Minister. The old man's getting minute-by-minute updates. I wish I had something to tell him."
"You've covered every possible option. Now you just have to sit and wait for something to break. They have to make a move somewhere, and when they do, we'll be on to them."
"I wish I could share your optimism." Harry grimaced with pain and appeared suddenly very tired.
"I'm going to go and lie down for a while."
He walked slowly toward the door. Vickery said, "Is Grace Clarendon on duty tonight?"
"Yeah, I think so."
The telephone rang. Basil Boothby said,
"Come upstairs straight away, Alfred."
The green light shone over Boothby's door. Vickery went inside and found Sir Basil pacing and chain-smoking. He had stripped off his jacket, his waistcoat was unbuttoned, and he had loosened his tie. He angrily waved Vickery toward a chair and said,
"Sit down, Alfred. Well, the lights are burning all over London tonight. Grosvenor Square,
Eisenhower's personal headquarters at Hayes Lodge, the underground war rooms, and they all want to know one thing. Does Hitler know it's Normandy? Is the invasion dead even before we begin?
We obviously have no way of knowing yet.
My God! Boothby ground out his cigarette and immediately lit another one. Two special branch officers dead, two more wounded. Thank God for Harry.
He's downstairs now. I'm sure he'd like to hear that from you in person.
We don't have time for pep talks, Alfred. We need to stop them and stop them quickly. I don't have to explain the stakes to you.
No, you don't, Sir Basil.
The Prime Minister wants updates every 30 minutes. Is there anything I can tell him?
Unfortunately, no. We've covered every possible route of escape. I wish I could say with certainty that we'll catch them, but I think it would be unwise to underestimate them. They have proven that time and time again.
Boothby resumed his pacing. Two men dead, three wounded, and two spies possessing the knowledge to unravel our entire deception plan running loose. Needless to say, this is the worst disaster in the history of this department.
Special Branch went in with the force they deemed necessary to arrest her. Obviously, they made a miscalculation.
Boothby stopped pacing and fixed the gunman's gaze on Vickery. Don't attempt to blame Special Branch for what happened, Alfred. You were the senior man on the scene. That aspect of Kettledrum was your responsibility.
I realize that, Sir Basil.
Good. Because when this is all over, an internal review will be convened, and I doubt your performance will be viewed in a favorable light.
Vickery stood up. Is that all, Sir Basil?
Yes.
Vickery turned and walked toward the door.
The distant wail of the air raid sirens started up while Vickery was taking the stairs down to registry. The rooms were in half darkness, just a couple of lights burning. Vickery, as always, noticed the smell of the place. Rotting paper, dust, damp, the faint residue of Nicholas Jago's vile pipe. He looked at Jago's glass-enclosed office. The light was out and the door was closed tightly. He heard the sharp smack of women's shoes and recognized the angry cadence of Grace Clarendon's brisk parade ground march. He saw her shock of blonde hair flash past the stacks like an apparition, then vanish. He followed her into one of the side rooms and called her name from a long way off, so as not to startle her. She turned, stared at him with hostile green eyes, then turned away from him again and resumed her filing. "Is this official, Professor Vickery?" she said. "If it's not, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. You've caused enough problems for me. If I'm seen talking to you again, I'll be lucky to get a job as a bloody blackout warden. Please leave, Professor."
"I need to see a file, Grace."
"You know the procedure, Professor. Fill out a request slip. If your request is approved, you can see the file."
"I won't be given approval to see the file I need to see."
"Then you can't see it." Her voice had taken on the cold efficiency of a headmistress. "Those are the rules."
The first bombs fell, across the river by the feel of it. Then the anti-aircraft batteries in the parks opened up. Vickery heard the drone of Heinkel bombers overhead. Grace stopped her filing and looked up. A stick of bombs fell nearby, too damned close, because the whole building shook and files tumbled from the shelves. Grace looked at the mess and said,
"Bloody hell!
I know Boothby is making you do things against your will. I heard you quarreling in his office, and I saw you getting into his car in Northumberland Avenue last night. And don't tell me you're seeing him romantically, because I know you're in love with Harry."
Vickery noticed the shine of tears in her green eyes, and the file in her hand began to tremble. "It's your bloody fault," she snapped. "If you hadn't told him about the Fogel file, I wouldn't be in this mess."
"What is he making you do?" She hesitated.
"Please leave, Professor. Please."
"I'm not leaving until you tell me what Boothby wanted you to do."
"Damn it, Professor Vickery. He wanted me to spy on you. And on Harry."
She forced herself to lower her voice.
"Anything Harry told me, in bed or anywhere else, I was supposed to tell him."
"What did you tell him?"
"Anything Harry mentioned to me about the case and the progress of the investigation. I also told him about the registry search you requested."
She pulled a handful of files from her cart and resumed her filing.
"I heard Harry was involved in that mess at Earl's Court."
He was indeed. In fact, he's the man of the hour.
Was he hurt?
Vickery nodded. He's upstairs. The doctors couldn't keep him in bed.
He probably did something stupid, didn't he? Trying to prove himself. God, he can be such a stupid, stubborn idiot sometimes.
Grace, I need to see a file. Boothby's going to sack me when this business is over, and I need to know why.
She stared at him, a grave expression on her face.
You're serious, aren't you, Professor?
Unfortunately, yes.
She looked at him wordlessly for a moment while the building shuddered with the shock waves of the bombs.
What's the file?
She asked. An operation called Kettledrum. Grace furrowed her eyebrows in confusion.
Isn't that the code name of the operation you're involved in now?
Yes.
Hold on a minute. You want me to risk my neck to show you the file on your own case?
Something like that, Vickery said. Except I want you to cross-reference it with a different case officer.
Who?
Vickery looked directly into her green eyes and mouthed the initials B.B. She came back 5 minutes later, an empty file folder in her hand.
Operation Kettledrum, she said. Terminated.
Where are the contents?
Either destroyed or with the case officer.
When was the file opened?
Vickery asked. Grace looked at the tab on the file, then at Vickery.
That's funny, she said. According to this, Operation Kettledrum was initiated in October 1943.
Chapter 51. Cambridgeshire, England. By the time Scotland Yard responded to Alfred Vickery's demand for roadblocks, Horst Neumann had left London and was racing northward along the A10. The van had obviously been well maintained. It would do at least 60 miles per hour, and the motor ran smoothly. The tyres still had a decent amount of tread on them, and they gripped the wet road surprisingly well. And it had one other practical feature. A black van did not stand out from the other commercial vehicles on the road. Since petrol rationing made private motoring all but impossible, anyone driving an automobile that time of night might be stopped by the police and questioned. The road ran straight across mostly flat terrain. Neumann hunched forward over the steering wheel as he drove, peering into the little pool of light thrown off by the shrouded headlamps. For a moment he considered removing the blackout shades, but decided it was too risky. He flashed through villages with funny names, Puckeridge, Buntingford. Dark, not a light burning, no one moving about. It was as if the clock had been turned back 2,000 years. Neumann would scarcely have been surprised to see a Roman legion encamped along the banks of the River Cam. More villages. Melbourne, Foxton, Newton, Hoxton. During his preparation at Fogel's farmhouse outside Berlin, Neumann had spent hours studying old Ordnance Survey maps of Britain. He suspected he knew the roads and pathways of East Anglia as well as most Englishmen, perhaps better. Melbourne, Foxton, Newton, Hoxton. He was approaching Cambridge. Cambridge represented trouble. Surely MI5 had alerted police forces in the large cities and towns. Neumann reckoned the police in the villages and hamlets did not pose much of a threat. They made their rounds on foot or bicycle, and rarely had cars, and communications were so poor that word might not even have been passed to them. He was flashing through the blacked-out villages so quickly a police officer would never really see them. Cities like Cambridge were different. MI5 had probably alerted the Cambridge police force. They had enough men to mount a roadblock on a large route like the A10. They had cars and could engage in a pursuit. Neumann knew the roads and was a capable driver, but he would be no match for an experienced local police officer. Before reaching Cambridge, Neumann turned into a small side road. He skirted the base of the Gog Magog Hills and headed north along the eastern edge of the city. Even in the gloom of the blackout, he could make out the spires of King's and St. John's. He passed through a village called Horningsea, crossed the Cam, and entered Waterbeach, a village that lay astride the A10. He drove slowly through the darkened streets until he found the largest one. There were no signs for the A10, but he assumed this had to be it. He turned right, headed north, and after a moment was racing through the lonely flatness of the fens. The miles passed very quickly. The rain eased, but in the fenland the wind, with nothing in its path between here and the North Sea, battered the van like a child's toy. The road ran near the banks of the River Great Ouse, then across Southery Fens. They passed through the villages of Southery and Hilgay. The next large town was Downham Market, smaller than Cambridge, but Neumann assumed it had its own police force and was therefore a threat. He repeated the same move he made in Cambridge, turning onto a smaller side road, skirting the edge of town, rejoining the A10 in the north. 10 miles on, he came to King's Lynn, the port on the southeastern base of the Wash and largest town on the Norfolk coast. Neumann turned off the A10 again and picked up a small B road east of the city. The road was poor, an unpaved single-lane track in many places, and the terrain turned hilly and wooded. He stopped and poured 2 of the jerrycans of petrol into the tank. The weather worsened the closer they moved to the coast. At times Neumann seemed to be travelling at a walking pace. He feared he had made a mistake by turning off the better road, that he was being too cautious. After more than an hour of difficult driving, he reached the coastline. He passed through Hampton Sands, crossed the Sea Creek, and accelerated along the track. He felt relieved, finally a familiar road. The Doherty cottage appeared in the distance. Neumann turned into the drive. He saw the door open and the glow of a kerosene lamp moving toward them. It was Sean Doherty, dressed in his oilskin and sou'wester, a shotgun over his arm. Sean Doherty had not been worried when Neumann did not arrive in Hunstanton on the afternoon train. Neumann had warned him he might be in London longer than usual. Doherty decided to wait for the evening train. He left the station and went into a nearby pub. He ordered a potato and carrot pie and washed it down with 2 glasses of ale. Then he went out and walked along the waterfront. Before the war, Hunstanton was a popular summer beach resort because its location on the eastern edge of the Wash provided remarkable sunsets over the water. On this night, the old Edwardian resort hotels were mostly empty, despondent-looking in the steady rain. Sunset was nothing more than the last grey light leaking from the storm clouds. Doherty left the waterfront and returned to the station to meet the evening train. He stood on the platform, smoking, watching the handful of passengers disembarking. When Neumann was not among them, Doherty became alarmed. He drove back to Hampton Sands, thinking about Neumann's words earlier that week. Neumann had said it was possible the operation might be about to end, possible that he might be leaving England and heading back to Berlin. Doherty thought, but why wasn't he on the damned train? He arrived at the cottage and let himself inside. Mary, sitting next to the fire, glared at him, then went upstairs. Doherty switched on the wireless. The news bulletin caught his attention. A nationwide search was underway for 2 suspected killers who had taken part in a gun battle with police earlier that evening in the section of London known as Earl's Court. Doherty turned up the volume as the newsreader gave a description of the 2 suspects. The first, surprisingly, was a woman. The second was a man who matched Horst Neumann's description perfectly. Doherty shut off the radio. Was it possible the 2 suspects in the Earl's Court shooting were Neumann and the other agent? Were they now on the run from MI5 and half the police in Britain? Were they heading toward Hampton Sands, or were they going to leave him behind? Then he thought, do the British know I'm a spy, too? He went upstairs, threw a change of clothes into a small canvas bag, and came back downstairs again. He went out to the barn, found his shotgun, and loaded a pair of cartridges into the barrel. Returning to the cottage, Doherty sat in the window, waiting. He had almost given up hope when he spotted the shaded headlamps moving along the road toward the cottage. When the car turned into the farmyard, he could see it was Neumann behind the wheel. There was a woman sitting in the passenger seat. Doherty stood up and pulled on his coat and hat. He lit the kerosene lamp, picked up his shotgun, and went outside into the rain. Martin Colville examined his face in the mirror. Broken nose, black eyes, swollen lips, a contusion on the right side of his face. He went into the kitchen and poured the last precious drops of whiskey from a bottle. Every instinct in Colville's body told him there was something wrong about the man named James Porter. He didn't believe he was a wounded British soldier. He didn't believe he was an old acquaintance of Sean Doherty's. He didn't believe he had come to Hampton Sands for the ocean air. He touched his ruined face, thinking, "No one's ever done this to me in my life, and I'm not going to let that little bastard get away with it." Colville drank the whiskey in one swallow, then placed the empty bottle and the glass in the sink. Outside, he heard the grumble of a motor. He went to the door and looked out. A van swept past. Colville could see James Porter behind the wheel and a woman in the passenger seat. He closed the door, thinking, "What in the hell is he doing out driving this time of night? And where did he get the van?" He decided he would find out for himself. He went into the sitting room and took down an old 12-gauge shotgun from over the mantel. The shells were in a kitchen drawer. He opened it and dug through the jumble inside until he found the box. He went outside and climbed on his bicycle. A moment later, Colville was pedaling through the rain, shotgun across the handlebars, toward the Dohertys' cottage. Jenny Colville, upstairs in her bedroom, heard the front door open and close once. Then she heard the sound of a passing vehicle, unusual at this time of night. When she heard the door open and close a second time, she became alarmed. She rose from her bed and crossed the room. She parted the curtain and looked down in time to see her father pedaling away through the darkness. She pounded on the window, but it was in vain. Within seconds, he was gone. Jenny was wearing nothing but a flannel nightgown. She took it off, pulled on a pair of trousers and a sweater, and went downstairs. Her Wellington boots were by the door. Pulling them onto her feet, she noticed the shotgun that usually hung over the fireplace was gone. She looked into the kitchen and saw that the drawer where the shells were kept was open. Quickly, she pulled on her coat and went outside. Jenny groped through the darkness until she found her bicycle leaning against the side of the cottage. She pushed it down the path, climbed onto the saddle, and pedaled after her father toward the Doherty cottage, thinking, "Please God, let me stop him before someone ends up dead tonight." Sean Doherty pulled open the door of the barn and led them inside behind the light of the kerosene lantern. He removed his sou'wester and unbuttoned his coat, then looked at Neumann and the woman. Neumann said, "Sean Doherty, meet Catherine Blake. Sean used to be with an outfit called the Irish Republican Army, but he's been on loan to us for the war. Catherine works for Kurt Vogel, too. She's been living in England under deep cover since 1938. It gave Catherine a strange sensation to hear her background and work discussed so casually. After the years of hiding her identity, after all the precautions, after all the anxiety, it was difficult to imagine it was about to end. Doherty looked at her, then at Neumann. "The BBC's been running bulletins all night about a gun battle at Earl's Court. I suppose you were involved in that." Neumann nodded. "They weren't ordinary London police. MI5 and Special Branch, I'd say. What's the radio saying?" "You killed two of them and wounded three more. They've mounted a nationwide search for you and asked for help from the general public. Half the country's probably out beating the bushes for you right now. I'm surprised you made it this far." "We stayed out of the big towns. It seemed to work. We haven't seen any police on the road so far." "Well, it won't last. You can be sure of that." Neumann looked at his wristwatch. A few minutes after midnight. He picked up Sean's kerosene lamp and carried it to the work table. He took down the radio from the cabinet and switched on the power. "The submarine is on patrol in the North Sea. After receiving our signal, it will move exactly 10 miles due east of Spurn Head and remain there until 6 a.m. If we don't appear, it turns from the coast and waits to hear from us." Catherine said, "And how exactly are we going to get 10 miles due east of Spurn Head?" Doherty stepped forward. "There's a fellow named Jack Kincaid. He has a small fishing boat at a quay on the River Humber." Doherty dug out an old pre-war ordnance survey map. "The boat's here," he said, jabbing at the map, "in a town called Cleethorpes. It's about 100 miles up the coast. It will be hard driving on a dirty night like this, with a blackout to contend with. Kincaid has a flat over a garage on the waterfront. I spoke to him yesterday.
He knows we might be coming.
Neumann nodded and said, If we leave now, we have about 6 hours of driving time. I say we can make it tonight. The next rendezvous opportunity with the submarine is 3 days from now. I don't relish the idea of hiding out for 3 days with every policeman in Britain beating the bushes for us. I say we go tonight.
Catherine nodded. Neumann slipped on the earphones and tuned the radio to the proper frequency. He tapped out an identification signal and waited for a reply. A few seconds later, the radio operator aboard the U-boat asked Neumann to proceed. Neumann drew a deep breath, carefully tapped out the message, then signed off and shut down the radio.
Which leaves one more thing, he said, turning to Doherty. Are you coming with us?
He nodded.
I've talked it over with Mary. She sees it my way. I'll come back to Germany with you. Then Fogel and his friends can help me make my way back to Ireland. Mary will come across when I'm there. We've got friends and family who'll look after us until we get settled. We'll be all right.
And how's Mary taking it? Doherty's face hardened into a tight-lipped frown. Neumann knew it was quite likely he and Mary might never see each other again. He reached for the kerosene lamp, put a hand on Doherty's shoulder, and said, Let's go. Martin Colville, standing astride his bicycle, breathing heavily, saw a light burning inside Doherty's barn. He laid his bicycle next to the road, then quietly crossed the meadow and crouched outside the barn. He struggled to understand the conversation taking place inside over the smack of the falling rain. It was unbelievable. Sean Doherty, working for the Nazis. The man called James Porter, a German agent. A nest of German spies operating right here in Hampton Sands. Colville strained to hear more of the conversation. They were planning to drive up the coast to Lincolnshire and take a boat out to sea to meet a submarine. Colville felt his heart careening inside his chest and his breath coming quickly. He forced himself to be calm, to think clearly. He had two choices: turn away, ride back to the village and alert the authorities, or go inside the barn and take them into custody on his own. Each option had disadvantages. If he left for help, Doherty and the spies would probably be gone by the time he returned. There were few police along the Norfolk coast, hardly enough to mount a search. If he went in alone, he would be outnumbered. He could see Sean had his shotgun, and he assumed the two others were armed too. Still, he would have the advantage of surprise. There was another reason why he liked the second option. He would enjoy personally settling the score with the German who called himself James Porter. Colville knew he had to act, and act quickly. He broke open the box of shells, removed two, and snapped them into the barrel of the old 12-gauge. He had never aimed the thing at anything more threatening than a partridge or a pheasant. He wondered whether he would have the stomach to pull the trigger on a human being. He rose and took a step toward the door. Jenny pedaled until her legs burned, through the village, past the church and the cemetery, over the sea creek. The air was filled with the sound of the storm and the rush of the sea. Rain lashed against her face, and the wind nearly blew her over. Jenny spotted her father's bicycle in the grass along the track and stopped next to it. Why leave it here? Why not ride it all the way to the cottage? She thought she knew the answer. He was trying to sneak up without being seen. It was then she heard the sound of a shotgun blast from Sean's barn. Jenny screamed, leapt from her bicycle, and let it fall next to her father's. She ran across the meadow, thinking, Please, God, don't let him be dead! Don't let him be dead! Chapter 52. Scarborough, England. Approximately 100 miles north of Hampton Sands, Charlotte Endicott pedalled her bicycle into the small gravel compound outside the Y-Service listening station at Scarborough. The ride from her digs at a cramped guest house in town had been brutal, wind and rain the entire way. Soaked and chilled to the bone, she dismounted and leaned her bicycle next to several others in the stand. The wind gusted, moaning through the three huge rectangular antennas that stood atop the cliffs overlooking the North Sea. Charlotte Endicott glanced up at them, swaying visibly as she hurried across the compound. She pulled open the door of the hut and went inside before the wind slammed it shut. She had a few minutes before her shift began. She removed her soaking raincoat, untied her hat, and hung them both on a dilapidated coat tree in the corner. The hut was cold and draughty, built for utility, not comfort. It did have a small canteen, though. Charlotte went inside, poured herself a cup of hot tea, sat down at one of the small tables, and lit a cigarette. A filthy habit, she knew. But if she could hold a job like a man, she could smoke like one. Besides, she liked the way they made her look. Sexy, sophisticated, a little older than her 23 years. She also had become addicted to the damn things. The work was stressful, the hours brutal, and life in Scarborough was dreadfully boring. But she loved every moment of it. There had been only one time when she truly hated it, the Battle of Britain. During the long and horrible dogfights, the wrens at Scarborough could listen to the cockpit chatter of the British and German pilots. Once she heard an English boy screaming and crying for his mother as his crippled Spitfire fell helplessly toward the sea. When she lost contact with him, Charlotte ran outside into the compound and threw up. She was glad those days were over. Charlotte looked up at the clock. Nearly midnight. Time to go on duty. She stood and smoothed her damp uniform. She took one last pull at her cigarette. Smoking wasn't allowed in the hole. Then crushed it out in a small metal ashtray overflowing with butts. She left the canteen and walked toward the operations room. She flashed her identification badge at the guard. He scrutinized it carefully, even though he had seen it 100 times before, then handed it back to her, smiling a little more than necessary. Charlotte knew she was an attractive girl, but there was no place for that sort of thing here. She pushed open the doors, entered the hole, and sat down at her regular spot. It gave her a brief chill, as always. She stared at the luminous dials of her RCA AR-88 superheterodyne communications receiver for a moment, and then slipped on her earphones. The RCA's special interference-cutting crystals allowed her to monitor German Morse senders all across Northern Europe. She tuned her receiver to the band of frequencies she had been assigned to patrol that night, and settled in. The German Morse senders were the fastest keyers in the world. Charlotte could immediately identify many by their distinctive keying style, or fist, and she and the other wrens had nicknames for them. Wagner, Beethoven, Zeppelin. Charlotte didn't have to wait long for her first action that night. A few minutes after midnight, she heard a burst of Morse in a fist she did not recognize. The cadence was poor, the pace slow and uncertain. An amateur, she thought. Someone who didn't use their radio much. Certainly not one of the professionals at BDU, the Kriegsmarine headquarters. Acting quickly, she made a recording of the transmission on the oscillograph, a device that would in effect create a radio fingerprint of the signal called a TINA, and furiously scribbled the Morse message onto a sheet of paper. When the amateur finished, Charlotte heard another burst of code on the same frequency. This was no amateur. Charlotte and the other wrens had heard him before. They had nicknamed him Fritz. He was a radio operator aboard a U-boat. Charlotte quickly transcribed this message as well. Fritz's transmission was followed by another burst of sloppy Morse by the amateur, and then the communication went dead. Charlotte removed her headset, tore off the printout of the oscillograph, and marched across the room. Normally she would simply pass on the Morse transcripts of the messages to the motorcycle courier, who in turn would rush them to Bletchley Park for decoding. But there was something different about this communication. She could feel it in the fist of the radio operators. Fritz aboard a U-boat, an amateur somewhere else. She suspected she knew what it was, but she would have to make a damned convincing case. She presented herself to the night supervisor, a pale, exhausted-looking man called Lowe. She dropped the transcripts and the oscillograph on his desk. He looked up at her, a quizzical expression on his face. "I could be completely wrong, sir," Charlotte said, mustering the most authoritative voice she could. "But I think I just overheard a German spy signaling a U-boat off the coast." Kapitänleutnant Max Hoffmann would never get used to the stench of a U-boat that has been submerged too long. Sweat, urine, diesel oil, potatoes, semen. The assault on his nostrils was so intense he would gladly stand watch on the conning tower in a gale rather than stay inside. Standing in the control room of U-509, he could feel the throb of its electric motors beneath his feet as they wheeled in a monotonous circle 20 miles from the British coastline. A fine mist hung inside the submarine, creating a halo around every light. Every surface was cool and wet to the touch. Hoffman liked to imagine it was dew on a spring morning, but one look at the cramped, claustrophobic world he inhabited robbed him of that fantasy very quickly. It was a tedious assignment, sitting off the coast of Britain for weeks on end, waiting for one of Canaris's spies. Of Hoffman's crew, only his first officer knew the true purpose of their mission. The rest of the men probably suspected as much, since they weren't on patrol. Still, things could be worse. Given the extraordinary loss rate among the U-Boot-Waffe, nearly 90%, Hoffman and his crew were damned lucky to have survived this long. The first officer came onto the bridge, face grave, a sheet of paper in his hand. Hoffman looked at the man, depressed by the notion that he probably looked just as bad. Sunken eyes, hollow cheeks, the grey pallor of a submariner, the unkempt beard because there was too little fresh water to waste on shaving. The first officer said, "Our man in Britain has finally surfaced. He'd like a lift home tonight." Hoffman smiled, thinking, "Finally. We pick him up and head back to France for some good food and clean sheets." He said, "What's the latest weather?" "Not good, Herr Kalloy," the first officer said, using the customary diminutive form of Kapitän Leutnant. "Heavy rains, winds 30 miles per hour from the northwest, seas 10 to 12. "Jesus Christ! And he'll probably be coming in a rowboat, if we're lucky. Organize a reception party and prepare to surface. Have the radio operator inform BDU of our plans. Set a course for the rendezvous point. I'll go up top with the lookouts. I don't care how bad the weather is." Hoffman made a face. "I can't stand the fucking smell in here any longer." "Yes, Herr Kalloy." The first officer shouted a series of commands, echoed among the crew. 2 minutes later, U-509 punched through the stormy surface of the North Sea. The system was known as high-frequency direction finding, but almost everyone involved with the project knew it as Huff-Duff. It worked on the principle of triangulation. The radio fingerprint created by the oscillograph at Scarborough could be used to identify the type of transmitter and its power supply. If the Y-service stations at Flowerdown and Iceland also ran oscillographs, the three recordings could be used to establish bearing lines, known as cuts, which could then be used to locate the position of the transmitter. Sometimes Huff-Duff could pinpoint a radio to within 10 miles of its geographical location. Usually the system was much less accurate, 30 to 50 miles. Commander Lowe did not believe Charlotte Endicott was completely wrong. In fact, he believed she had stumbled onto something critical. Earlier that evening, a Major Vickery from MI5 had sent out an alert to the Y-service to look for this very sort of thing. Lowe spent the next few minutes speaking with his counterparts in Flowerdown and Iceland, attempting to plot a fix on the transmitter. Unfortunately, the communication was short, the fix not terribly precise. In fact, Lowe could narrow it only to a rather large portion of eastern England, all of Norfolk and much of Suffolk, Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire. Probably not much of a help, but at least it was something. Lowe dug through the papers on his desk until he found Vickery's number in London, and then reached for his secure telephone. Atmospheric conditions over northern Europe made shortwave communication between the British Isles and Berlin virtually impossible. As a result, the Abwehr's radio center was housed in the basement of a large mansion in the Hamburg suburb of Wohldorf, 150 miles northwest of the German capital. 5 minutes after U-509's radio operator transmitted his message to BDU in northern France, the duty officer at BDU flashed a brief message to Hamburg. The duty officer at Hamburg was an Abwehr veteran named Captain Schmidt. He recorded the message, placed a priority call to Abwehr headquarters in Berlin on the secure line, and informed Lieutenant Werner Ulbricht of the developments. Schmidt then left the mansion and walked down the street to a nearby hotel, where he booked a second call to Berlin. He did not want to make this call from the thoroughly bugged lines of the Abwehr post, for the number he gave the operator was for Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg's office at Prinz Albrechtstrasse. Unfortunately for Schmidt, Schellenberg had discovered he was having a rather lurid affair with a 16-year-old boy in Hamburg. Schmidt readily agreed to go to work for Schellenberg to avoid exposure. When the call went through, he spoke to one of Schellenberg's many assistants. The general was dining out that night, and informed him of the news. Kurt Vogel had decided to spend a rare evening at his small flat a few blocks from Tirpitzufer. Ulbricht reached him there by telephone, and informed him that Horst Neumann had contacted the submarine and was coming out. 5 minutes later, Vogel was letting himself out the front door of his building and walking through the rain toward Tirpitzufer. At that same moment, Walter Schellenberg checked in with his office and was told of developments in Britain. He then telephoned Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler and briefed him. Himmler ordered Schellenberg to come to Prince Albrechtstrasse. It was going to be a long night, and he wanted some company. As it happened, Schellenberg and Vogel arrived at their respective offices at precisely the same moment and settled in for the wait. The location of the Allied invasion of France. The life of Admiral Canaris. And it all depended on the word of a couple of spies on the run from MI5. Chapter 53. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. Martin Colville used the barrel of his shotgun to push back the door of the barn. Neumann, still standing next to the radio, heard the noise. He reached for his Mauser as Colville stepped inside. Colville spotted Neumann going for the gun. He turned, leveled the shotgun, and fired. Neumann leapt out of the way, hitting the floor of the barn and rolling. The roar of the shotgun blast in the confined space of the barn was deafening. The radio disintegrated. Colville aimed the gun at Neumann a second time. Neumann rolled up onto his elbows, Mauser in his outstretched hands. Sean Doherty stepped forward, screaming at Colville to stop. Colville turned the gun on Doherty and squeezed the trigger. The blast struck Doherty in the chest, lifting him off his feet and driving him backward like a rag doll. He fell on his back, blood pumping from the gaping wound in his chest, and died within a matter of seconds. Neumann fired, hitting Colville in the shoulder and spinning him around. Catherine had by now drawn her own Mauser, and using both hands, leveled it at Colville's head. She fired twice rapidly, the silencer dampening the blasts to a dull thud. Colville's head exploded, and he was dead before his body hit the floor of Doherty's barn. Mary Doherty lay in an agitated half-sleep upstairs in her bed when she heard the first shotgun blast. She sat bolt upright and swung her feet to the floor as the second blast shattered the night. She threw off her blanket and raced downstairs. The cottage was in darkness, the sitting room and the kitchen deserted. She went outside. Rain beat against her face. She realized that she was wearing only her flannel nightgown. There was silence now, only the sound of the storm. She looked out across the garden and spotted an unfamiliar black van in the drive. She turned toward the barn and saw light burning there. She called out, "Sean!" and started running toward the barn. Mary's feet were bare, the ground cold and sodden. She called Sean's name several more times as she ran. A shaft of faint light spilled from the open door of the barn, illuminating a box of shotgun shells on the ground. Stepping inside, she gasped. A scream caught in her throat and would not come out. The first thing she saw was the body of Martin Colville lying on the floor of the barn a few feet away from her. Part of the head was missing, and blood and tissue were scattered everywhere. She felt her stomach retch. Then she turned her attention to the second body. It was on its back, arms flung wide. Somehow, in death, the ankles had become crossed, as though he were napping. Blood obscured the face. For a brief second, Mary permitted herself to hope that it wasn't actually Sean lying there dead. Then she looked at the old Wellington boots and oilskin coat and knew it was him. The scream that had been trapped in her throat came out. Mary cried, "Oh, Sean! Oh, my God, Sean, what have you done?" She looked up and saw Horst Neumann standing over Sean's body, a gun in his hand. Standing a few feet from Neumann was a woman, holding a pistol in her hands aimed at Mary's head. Mary looked back at Neumann and screamed, "Did you do this? Did you?" "It was Colville," Neumann said. "He came in here, gun blazing. Sean got in the way." "I'm sorry, Mary."
"No, Horst. Martin may have pulled the trigger, but you did this to him. Make no mistake about it. You and your friends in Berlin, you're the ones who did this to him."
Neumann said nothing. Catherine still stood with the Mauser levelled at Mary's head. Neumann stepped in, took hold of the weapon, and gently lowered it toward the ground. Jenny Colville stayed in the darkened meadow and approached the barn from the side, hidden from view. She crouched against the outside wall, rain smacking against her oilskin, and listened to the conversation taking place inside. She heard the voice of the man she knew as James Porter, though Mary had called him something else, something that sounded like horse.
"It was Colville. Sean got in the way. I'm sorry, Mary."
Then she heard Mary's voice. It had risen in pitch and quivered with anger and grief.
"You did this to him! You and your friends in Berlin!"
She waited to hear her father's voice. She waited to hear Sean's voice. Nothing. She knew then they both were dead.
"You and your friends in Berlin!"
Jenny thought, "What are you saying, Mary?" And then it all came together in her mind, like pieces of a puzzle that suddenly fall in the right order. Sean on the beach that night, the sudden appearance of the man called James Porter, Mary's warning to her earlier that afternoon.
"He's not what he appears to be. He's not for you, Jenny."
Jenny did not understand what Mary was trying to say at the time, but now she thought she did. The man she knew as James Porter was a German spy, and that meant Sean was a spy for the Germans too. Jenny's father must have discovered the truth and confronted them, and now he was lying dead on the floor of Sean Doherty's barn. Jenny wanted to scream. She felt hot tears pouring from her eyes down her cheeks. She raised her hands to her mouth to smother the sound of her crying. She had fallen in love with him, but he had lied to her and used her, and he was a German spy, and he probably just killed her father. There was movement inside the barn. Movement and a few soft exchanges of instructions that Jenny could not hear. She heard the German spy's voice, and she heard a woman's voice that did not belong to Mary. Then she saw the spy emerge from the barn and walk down the drive, torch in hand. He was heading toward the bicycles. If he found them, he would realize she was here too, and he would come looking for her. Jenny forced herself to breathe slowly, evenly, to think clearly. She was being battered by several emotions. She was frightened. She was sick with the thought of her father and Sean dead. But more than anything else, she was angry. She had been lied to and betrayed, and now she was driven by one overwhelming desire. She wanted them caught, and she wanted them punished. Jenny knew she would be no use if the German found her. But what to do? She could try to run to the village. There was a telephone at the hotel and the pub. She could contact the police, and the police could come and arrest them. But the village was the first place the spies would look for her. There was just one way into the village from the Dohertys, across the bridge by St. John's Church. Jenny knew she could be caught very easily. She thought of a second option. They had to be leaving soon. They had just killed two people, after all. Jenny could hide for a short time until they had left. Then she could emerge and contact the police. She thought, but what if they take Mary with them? Mary would be better off if Jenny were free and trying to find help. Jenny watched the spy as he moved closer to the road. She saw the beam of his torch play over the surrounding ground. She saw it settle on something for a moment, then flash in her direction. Jenny gasped. He had found her bike. She rose and started to run. Horst Neumann spotted the pair of bicycles lying side by side in the grass at the edge of the road. He turned his torch toward the meadow, but the weak beam illuminated only a few feet in front of him. He lifted the bicycles, took hold of them by the handlebars, and rolled them up the drive. He left them at the back of Doherty's barn, hidden from view. She was out there, somewhere. He tried to picture what had happened. Her father storms out of the house with a gun. Jenny follows him and arrives at the Doherty's cottage in time to see the aftermath. Neumann guessed she was hiding, waiting for them to leave, and he thought he knew where. For a moment he considered letting her go, but Jenny was an intelligent girl. She would find a way to contact the police. The police would throw up roadblocks all around Hampton Sands. Making it to Lincolnshire in time to meet the submarine was going to be difficult enough. Allowing Jenny to remain free and contact the police would only make it tougher. Neumann went inside the barn. Catherine had covered the bodies with some old sacking. Mary was sitting in a chair, shaking violently. Neumann avoided her gaze.
"We have a problem," Neumann said. He gestured at the covered body of Martin Colville. "I found his daughter's bicycle. We have to assume she's here somewhere and knows what happened. We also have to assume she'll try to get help."
"Then go find her," Catherine said.
Neumann nodded. "Take Mary in the house, tie her up, gag her. I have an idea where Jenny might be going."
Neumann went outside and hurried through the rain to the van. He started the motor, reversed down the drive, and headed toward the beach. Catherine finished tying Mary to a wooden chair in the kitchen. She tore a tea cloth in two and wadded one half into a ball. She stuffed it into Mary's mouth, then tied the other half around her face in a tight gag. If she had her way, Catherine would kill her now. She did not like leaving a trail for the police to follow. But Neumann obviously felt some attachment to the woman. Besides, it would probably be many hours before anyone found her, perhaps longer. The cottage was isolated, nearly a mile from the village. It might be a day or two before anyone noticed that Sean, Mary, Colville, and the girl were missing. Still, every survival instinct told her it was best to kill her and be done with it. Neumann would never know. She would lie to him, tell him Mary was unharmed, and he would never find out. Catherine checked the knots one last time. Then she removed her Mauser from her coat pocket. She took hold of it, wrapped her index finger around the trigger, and touched the barrel to Mary's temple. Mary kept very still and stared defiantly at Catherine. "Remember, Jenny is coming with us," Catherine said. "If you tell the police, we'll know, and then we'll kill her. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Mary?"
Mary nodded once. Catherine took hold of the Mauser by the barrel, raised it into the air, and brought it down on the top of Mary's head. She slumped forward, unconscious, blood trickling through her hair toward her eyes. Catherine stood in front of the dying embers of the fire, waiting for Neumann and the girl, waiting to go home.